Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. If you're not currently affiliated with a community, church, or synagogue and would like to be part of the larger Beth Emmanuel family, you can apply for long-distance membership at BethEmmanuel.org/membership.
To attain this vision, the actual sight of God, is the highest aim. It is a consummation which will not be reached until the Messianic age. Only Moses had, to some extent, this vision. Yet, it is the business of all to try to reach this stage. Paul Levertov, Love and the Messianic Age. You'll often hear it read at weddings. I can think of no other chapter in the Bible that receives the attention accorded to Paul's famous ode to love, the so-called love chapter, that is, 1 Corinthians 13. The beautiful sentiments of the passage have stood the test of time, spoken fluently in every language, and transcended cultural barriers. It evokes some deep human longing, but reaches for a goal somewhere beyond us. It reads like poetry. Its exalted ideals lift the heart and inspire contemplation, while at the same time stinging the ego and wounding the proud heart. These words obtain a portion of divine revelation that exceeds human capacity and invention. And you'll often hear it read at weddings. And that's a good thing, because in 1 Corinthians 13, there's much more than mere romance going on here. In the tradition of C.S. Lewis, a distinction should be made between eros and agape, two different Greek terms for love, the first being like the love between a man and a woman, a romantic or sexual affection, the second being the love of brotherly affection, that of a father for his children, of God for his children, of the disciples of Yeshua for one another. A marriage needs both eros, which includes some attraction and emotional chemistry and romance, but it also needs agape, which transcends the ups and downs and swings of fickle human affection and attraction. A community of Yeshua's disciples also needs love, especially a Torah community which seeks to fulfill the commandments. We need to be reminded of our obligation to love God and to love others, the two greatest commandments on which all the other commandments of the Torah hang. Love for others, and especially for one another, needs to be of the agape type, which is the meaning of love that our master taught when he explained the Torah's words, "Love your neighbor as yourself," to mean, "Do unto others as you would have them do unto you." This is the love of 1 Corinthians 13. But what is going on here in the context? The famous love chapter comes, strangely enough, in the midst of a discussion about spiritual gifts and supernatural endowments and abilities. Paul interrupts that discussion to present his kingdom view, arguing that love is the keynote characteristic of the kingdom, not spiritual manifestations or revelations. This type of love, the love of the Master, the love that Yeshua imported into our world, the love of God that he taught and that he lived, is the love of the kingdom. So Paul presents love in contrast to spiritual gifts, miracles, manifestations, revelations, lofty visions, feats of faith, and mystical insights. He would rather have love. For our purpose today, and the reason I've selected this text, is that I believe Paul has in mind our Torah portion. While composing 1 Corinthians 13, I believe his mind was on the story told in Numbers 11 to 12, which concludes with the description of Moses as the most humble man that ever lived, the one to whom God spoke face to face and mouth to mouth as a man speaks to his friend. In this current age, there is no prophet greater than Moses, excepting, of course, the Messiah himself. Moses is the greatest of the prophets. The Torah says he saw his vision clearly, whereas the other prophets received divine revelation only through riddles, dreams, obscure visions, and difficult sayings. The sages say that Moses was like a man looking into a polished mirror, whereas all the other prophets saw only dimly, as one looking into a tarnished mirror. They said that Moses was like a man who gazes through a single lens, whereas all the other prophets were like men gazing through seven lenses. The Lord knew Moses and spoke to him conversationally, person to person. Therefore, there is no prophet in this age like Moses. How did Moses attain this great level? Only through humility, which is an abnegation of the self, a setting aside of the ego, a relaxing of demands, a silencing of the inner voice inside the head that says, I think, therefore I am. True humility loses the self. True humility is in stillness and acceptance. Be still and know that I am God. True humility loses the self in the sea of God's love until it is able to see the other. That's when love is possible, and not until then. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels but have not love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. The tongues of men is an idiom for the tongues of the 70 nations. On the first Shavuot, when God gave the Torah at Mount Sinai, he spoke in the 70 languages of the nations, which is to say, in all languages. When the apostles received the Spirit of God on Shavuot, they declared the good news of the Messiah in all languages. Paul himself was once in line for a seat on the Sanhedrin. And in those days, they used to say that to serve on the Sanhedrin, a judge needed to be fluent in all 70 of the languages. That, of course, is hyperbole, but Paul himself spoke Greek, Aramaic, Hebrew, Latin, and perhaps others. The 70 judges of the Sanhedrin correspond to the 70 nations, and it's in our Torah portion where we are first introduced to the 70 judges of the Sanhedrin. Moses summons 70 elders to the tabernacle, and the Lord takes from the Spirit resting on Moses and imparts that spiritual endowment to the 70 elders. The 70 elders all begin to prophesy, indicating that they too now have received a portion of the spirit of prophecy that rested upon Moses, and their authority will carry the same inspiration and authority as his. This is what our master meant when he said they sit in the seat of Moses. If I speak in the tongue of angels. The tongue of angels is an idiom for Hebrew. It's not numbered among the tongues of men, because it is the language of the Torah, and therefore the language of the creation of the universe and the language of heaven. But Paul is not impressed with himself or anyone else for their mastery of languages, whether they obtain that mastery through the hard work of learning and acquiring a foreign tongue, or through the miraculous and divine revelation of the Spirit which the apostles experienced. He says, if I speak both the holy tongue and foreign languages, but have not love, what does it profit? No matter how fluent, eloquent, or articulate he speaks, if he has not love, his words amount to noise and clatter, without sense in them, pointless noise. And if I have prophetic powers, and understand all mysteries and all knowledge. In our Torah portion, Moses was in sore distress over the burdens of leadership, the malcontented nature of the people, and his sense of isolation in the task. The Lord told him to designate the 70 elders, and he endowed them with the same spirit of prophecy, the same Holy Spirit that rested on Moses. They received the spirit of Nevuah. Eldad and Medad remained prophesying in the camp. When Joshua urged Moses to silence them, he replied, "Are you jealous for my sake? Would that all the Lord's people were prophets, that the Lord would put his spirit on them." With these words, Moses alluded to the ultimate revelation of the Messianic era when the spirit of the Lord will be poured out on all flesh and everyone will prophesy from the least of them to the greatest. It will be a universal endowment of the Holy Spirit so that everyone will know the Lord and understand all mysteries and all knowledge. The knowledge of the Lord will fill the earth as waters cover the sea. The sages say, in this world, the Shekhinah manifests itself only to chosen individuals. In the world to come, however, it is written in Isaiah 40, verse 5, the glory of the Lord will be revealed, and all flesh will see it together, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. When the Holy Spirit came upon the apostles, they received that spiritual endowment as a pledge and a down payment on the whole amount yet to be received in the Messianic era, when the Spirit of the Lord will be poured out on all flesh, and the glory of the Lord will be revealed, and all flesh will see it together. This is the context of 1 Corinthians 13, which comes in the midst of discussion about spiritual gifts and manifestations that God vouchsafed to the disciples of Yeshua through the outpouring of His Holy Spirit. The disciples of Yeshua are like Eldad and Medad prophesying in the camp. Through the Spirit, we have the key to understand all mysteries and all knowledge, as Paul explains earlier in the epistle. These things God has revealed to us through the Spirit. For the Spirit searches everything, even the depths of God. For who knows a person's thoughts except the Spirit of that person which is in him? So also no one comprehends the thoughts of God except the Spirit of God. Paul says that even if he possesses that spiritual endowment to prophesy and know the deep mysteries of the thoughts of God, if he has not love, he is nothing. And if I have all faith, so as to remove mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. Our Master Yeshua taught his disciples that if we possess faith, even a tiny small amount of it, no larger than that of a mustard seed, it is still sufficient to say to a mountain, "Be cast into the sea," and the mountain will move. This is an idiom for overcoming problems and obstacles, whatever they may be. If we have faith in God, we will be able to achieve what would appear impossible, even miracles. In our Torah portion, Moses expresses uncertainty, if not doubt, over the Lord's promise to provide meat for the host of Israel. He objects that even if they slaughtered all their herds and flocks, the quantities would not be sufficient. The Lord rebukes him with a rhetorical question. Has the arm of the Lord grown short? One with faith believes that all things are possible with God, and nothing is too difficult for the Lord. Our Master often told those who healed that their faith had accomplished the miracle. In those days, miracle workers and men of faith who performed wonders were called men of deeds. When Paul refers to having faith so as to remove mountains, he is speaking about such as these. But even a miracle worker without love is nothing. If I give away all I have, our Master called upon his disciples to perform extravagant acts of zechut, that is merit, such as giving away everything they had, all of their possessions, and giving them to the poor. He told the rich young man, "If you would be perfect, sell all that you have and give it to the poor." And he said to those who were considering becoming his disciples, "Count the cost. Any one of you who does not renounce all that he has cannot be my disciple." In the days of the apostles, the disciples were encouraged to sell their belongings to support the poor and to renounce wealth. Those who did so were considered to achieve zechut, laying up their treasure in heaven where moth and rust do not destroy. But Paul says, "Even if I give away everything, as the Master has taught, but I have not love, I gain no merit. And if I deliver up my body to be burned, but have not love, I gain nothing." Our Master told his disciples to take up their cross every day, willing to lay down their lives for his sake and for the sake of the kingdom. He told them not to fear those who destroy the body but cannot hurt the soul. To love God with all your heart is prayer. To love God with all your soul is martyrdom. And to love God with all your strength is your wealth and possessions. When Paul says, "If I deliver up my body to be burned," he invokes the story of Abraham and Isaac, in which Isaac willingly offered himself up as a burnt offering upon Abraham's altar. But despite such enormous sacrifices, if I have not love, I gain nothing. Apparently, it is possible to be a tzaddik for completely selfish reasons. Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. The Lord is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger, and rich in love. He is the Lord, a God, merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin. Love neither envies nor boasts, nor is it arrogant or rude, because these attributes are the opposite of humility. One who is arrogant thinks of himself or herself more highly than others. One who is rude treats others as unworthy of his or her respect. Joshua understood prophecy, but he did not yet understand love. Moses said, "Are you jealous for my sake?" Miriam and Aaron boasted, "Has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us also?" They envied the authority of Moses, and they spoke arrogantly. They spoke rudely about Moses, even maligning him for marrying a black woman. As it says, Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Cushite woman whom he had married, for he had married a Cushite woman. Envy and arrogance, boasting and unkind words. But regarding Moses, it says, "Now the man Moses was very meek, more than all people who were on the face of the earth. Not meek like a mouse, but meek like one of mighty strength, to be long-suffering, patient and kind, without envy, without ego, without the need to say to others, 'Look at me, look at what I am doing, look at how much I have done, look at my accomplishments.'" The Epistle of Clement says, "On account of envy, Aaron and Miriam had to make their abode without the camp." It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It doth not behave itself unseemly, the King James Version says. Nothing is more unseemly than a person rationalizing to defend himself or herself, to persuade others why he is right and everyone else is wrong. Baseless hatred always insists on its own way. The need to be right and to show other people that they are wrong, the need to have other people acknowledge that I am right, the need to win an argument. This is the essential nourishment of the ego, of the self, of the flesh. This is the pride of life. But is it so important to be right? Is it so important for others to know when we are right and they are wrong? Is it more important to be right than it is to be righteous? Why is it so important to be exonerated when falsely accused that the ego cannot bear it? But when our master was falsely accused, he made no answer. Though being reviled, he did not revile. Insulted, he did not insult, but prayed on behalf of his persecutors, "Father, forgive them." He forced no one to accept his views or to believe his teachings. He made no demands on people to accept his dogma. The New International Version of 1 Corinthians 13:5 offers a beautiful translation saying, "It is not rude, it is not self-seeking, it is not easily angered, it keeps no record of wrongs." That is to say, love does not keep score. It does not reach into the past to resurrect old insults, hurts, wrongs, and injustices, or to use them as weapons and arguments. It is our ego, our flesh, that wants to keep a record of wrongs. We are the ones always living in the past, always conjuring up the ghosts of the past, the things that happened to us, the memory of hurtful words, of betrayals, of old injuries. We summon them up from our record of wrongs and breathe fresh life into them to feel the emotions again. But love does not live in the past, nor does it dwell on the future. Love is only possible in the present moment. It keeps no record of wrongs, as Paul teaches elsewhere. Although all your deeds are written in a book, God has forgiven us all our transgressions, having canceled out the certificate of debt consisting of decrees against us, which was hostile to us, and he has taken it out of the way, having nailed it to the cross. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love takes no pleasure in sin or the mistreatment of others. It takes no pleasure in selfish indulgence, especially at the expense of others. Instead, love finds joy in the truth. What is the truth with which love rejoices? It's not the truth of being right or wrong about this ideology or that ideology. It's not even the truth of this particular narrow theology or that particular brand of dogma. Nor is it the joy of being right when others are wrong or of having the right answer to a question others cannot answer. It certainly is not the so-called truth behind a conspiracy theory. The truth in which love rejoices is the revelation of God. It's the knowledge of the truth of God, which dispels the deceptive illusion of this world of concealment, that is, the illusion of materialism in which there is no God and there is no love. The truth in which love rejoices is the knowledge of the insubstantiality and transience of life, the knowledge that behind this world of concealment is the truth of eternity, a spiritual dimension that leaves this world and its petty concerns pale and insignificant by comparison. This is the truth behind the world, the love and peace of God. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. It bears all things. This alludes to the recitation of the 13 attributes of God, in which God is said to carry three things. There are three things he bears: iniquity, transgression, and sin. The Proverbs say, "Hatred stirs up strife, but love covers all transgressions." This is what the Apostle Peter means when he says, "Above all, keep fervent in your love for one another, because love covers a multitude of sins." It believes all things, all the things that God has promised, and that everything that comes from God is for the good. It hopes all things. Love remains confident and fixed in the unshakable hope of the goodness of God and the fulfillment of his promises. Its hope is fueled by the unquenchable optimism of faith, which chooses to see only the good. It endures all things. Love has the strength to endure because it accepts suffering as part of the path to the good. Love accepts the current moment as part of the greater good in which it believes and hopes, and it knows that this too shall pass. Love never ends. As for prophecies, they will pass away. As for tongues, they will cease. As for knowledge, it will pass away. Prophecies, tongues, and divine knowledge of revelation, these are the endowments of the Spirit, manifestations of God's Spirit upon human beings. These are the things we started with at the beginning of the chapter, and they are the things from our Torah portion. Paul says, "As for prophecies, they will pass away." And in the Torah portion it says, "And as soon as the Spirit rested on them, they prophesied, but they did not continue doing so. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part, but when the perfect comes, the partial will pass away. In this age, we know only in part and prophesy only in part. There is no room for arrogance or conceit. Even the greatest prophet in this age, Moses himself, had no arrogance or conceit within him, because he knew that he knew only in part and prophesied only in part. Our master says, 'Among those born of women there has not arisen anyone greater, yet the one who is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he.' This means that the lowest prophet in the Messianic era will obtain a higher level of prophetic insight and revelation than the greatest prophet of this current age. When the perfect comes means when the resurrection from the dead comes. For we know in part and we prophesy in part, but when the perfect comes, the partial will pass. Then the partial will pass away, this world will pass away. We are looking toward a new heaven and a new earth, a world to come. When I was a child, I spoke like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I gave up childish ways. Paul compares the level of spiritual revelation we have received in this world to that of the reasoning and arguing of children. He compares the revelation of the Messianic era and the world to come to the reasoning of an adult who no longer thinks like a child. In this world, we think like children, so there is no justifiable cause for arrogance or belligerence. The vision we have received of God comes to us through seven lenses, like a man who looks into a tarnished mirror. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. The Torah says, "If there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, shall make myself known to him in a vision. I shall speak with him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my household. With him I speak mouth to mouth, even openly, and not in dark sayings. And he beholds the form of the Lord." Compared to Moses, we see in a mirror dimly. Our highest revelation is obscured, but in the age to come, like Moses. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I have been fully known. This is divine love, and the goal of all love, whether storge, philia, eros, or agape. Every type of love and experience of love, on some level or another, desires only to know the other and to be known of the other. Love desires to transcend the confines of the self and lose the identity of the self in another self, to know the beloved fully and to be known fully by the beloved. All human love is merely a pale and partial refraction of the bright and whole of God's vast love. Our desires to love and to be loved are born of His, the one who knows us fully. In correspondence to that love, we seek to love God with all our hearts, all our souls, and all our strength. But despite our best effort, we can know Him only in part. When the perfect comes, then we will know God fully, even as He knows us. The communion and the completion of love. So now faith, hope, and love abide. These three, but the greatest of these is love.
And learn from me, and find rest for your soul.